Imagine a world where happiness isn't just encouraged, it's chemically guaranteed. Where your purpose is predetermined before birth and the very concept of family is considered obscene. This is the chilling vision Aldous Huxley crafted in 1931, decades before social media algorithms and designer antidepressants. What makes Brave New World so unsettling isn't that it depicts a nightmare, but rather a paradise many would willingly choose. Unlike the brutal totalitarianism of Orwell's 1984, Huxley's dystopia controls through pleasure rather than pain. Citizens aren't terrorized, they're entertained and medicated into compliance. They don't fear their government, they love the comforts it provides. The world state's motto, community, identity, stability, sounds reasonable until you discover the horrifying price paid for this perfect order. As you scroll through your curated social media feed or reach for comfort rather than meaning, ask yourself, how far are we from Huxley's prediction that we would come to love our servitude? In the central London hatchery, human reproduction has been fully mechanized. Bokanovsky's process creates up to 96 identical humans from a single egg, establishing the foundation for social control. Embryos are chemically treated to suit predetermined roles. Alphas and betas receive optimal conditions, while oxygen deprivation creates the lower castes, gammas, deltas, and epsilons. Post-decanting conditioning continues. Delta babies are exposed to books and flowers, then shocked until they develop permanent aversions to both. The director explains they condition masses to hate nature while loving outdoor sports requiring expensive equipment, thus driving consumption of manufactured goods. Sleep teaching, hypnopia, reinforces the indoctrination through endless repetition of phrases like, "Alpha children wear gray. They work much harder than we do because they're so frightfully clever. I'm really awfully glad I'm a beta." This creates a population that not only accepts but cherishes its predetermined place, a control system more effective than physical constraints. In the world state, terms like mother, father, and family are considered obscene. Children are raised collectively with no knowledge of their biological origins, as parental attachment is seen as a primitive threat to stability. The state mandates universal promiscuity through the motto, "Everyone belongs to everyone else." Monogamy is discouraged. When Lenina dates Henry Foster for 4 months, her friend Fanny warns her about the impropriety of sustained relationships with one person. This sexual freedom serves as a form of control by preventing deep emotional bonds that might compete with loyalty to the state. Sex becomes purely recreational, stripped of intimacy. Women must wear Malthusian belts with contraceptives, and pregnancy is viewed with disgust. The result is a society of hollow interactions where people engage constantly but never truly connect. Their solidarity services and drug-fueled orgies offer only temporary relief from isolation. The system's true power lies in its ability to fundamentally reshape human emotional capacity. Ending is better than mending. The more stitches, the less riches. This hypnopathic slogan exemplifies the world state's mandate of constant consumption. Citizens are conditioned from birth to discard rather than repair, viewing frugality as antisocial. The economy demands perpetual consumption for stability. Children are conditioned against nature because a love of nature keeps no factories busy. Leisure requires elaborate equipment to ensure economic activity. And even death serves the system. Crematoriums recover phosphorus from corpses. Happiness isn't just encouraged, but required. Discomfort is immediately treated with soma, a perfect drug offering all the advantages of Christianity and alcohol, none of their defects. When Lenina sees Bernard's melancholy, she urges him to take a holiday from reality. Unhappiness becomes both unpleasant and morally wrong. The controller prioritizes happiness over truth or beauty because it promotes stability. People are happy, they get what they want, and they never want what they can't get. This engineered contentment eliminates art, literature, and religion as potential sources of dissatisfaction. Scientific research is restricted, creating a perpetually infantile population seeking immediate gratification rather than meaning, a society that mirrors modern consumer culture. John the Savage discovers Shakespeare's complete works on his reservation, finding in its poetic language a way to express complex emotions that neither his tribal upbringing nor world-state vocabulary could capture. Shakespeare becomes John's lens for understanding reality. He views Lenina through the prism of romantic heroines and, unlike Bernard and Helmholtz's vague discontent, uses this literary foundation to mount sophisticated challenges to the world state's philosophy. When Mustafa Mond justifies eliminating high art, John quotes Miranda's, "Oh, brave new world that has such people in it," from The Tempest. The quote's irony, originally expressing wonder, now revealing disillusionment, highlights the human depth sacrificed for comfort. However, Shakespeare also constrains John. His rigid adherence to Shakespearean ideals of chastity prevents him from connecting with Lenina, causing him to reject her genuine, if conditioned, expressions of desire. The novel suggests that while Shakespeare offers profound insights, merely transplanting these values into a radically different society is problematic. Neither John's romantic idealism nor the world state's utilitarian hedonism presents a complete vision of human potential. The philosophical heart of the novel emerges in the dialogue between Mustafa Mond, the world controller, and John the Savage. Mond represents not a typical villain, but a pragmatic leader who understands the cost of stability. Mond explains how the world state suppresses destabilizing scientific research and keeps works like the Bible and Shakespeare locked away. God isn't compatible with machinery and scientific medicine and universal happiness, he declares. As a young scientist, Mond chose stability over truth when offered either exile or conformity. While the islands for dissenters offer intellectual freedom, they remove all societal influence. The world state maintains order by eliminating the conditions for great art, scientific discovery, and spiritual depth. Actual happiness always looks pretty squalid in comparison with the overcompensations for misery, Mond observes. John's response frames the novel's central question. I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin. Is comfort worth the sacrifice of life's meaning? As the novel concludes, Bernard and Helmholtz are exiled to islands where they can pursue intellectual interests, while John's request for exile is denied by Mond, who insists the experiment must continue. John retreats to an abandoned lighthouse, living simply and performing purification rituals from his reservation upbringing. However, his private self-flagellation is filmed and becomes mass entertainment, drawing crowds who watch The Savage of Surrey as spectacle. In the final scene, during a Soma holiday orgy surrounded by a chanting crowd, John's self-punishment spirals into a breakdown. Overcome with disgust the next morning, he takes his own life. His death illustrates the inescapable reach of the world state, where even attempts at authentic living become commodified entertainment. The novel suggests humanity has lost something essential in its pursuit of comfort and stability, a warning that remains relevant today.